This week in Retronauts, I lost my lucky ball and cup, and now it's 4 years gone. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this is a special request episode about miscellaneous handhelds, courtesy of patron Jeff Lossick, who has said, please talk about miscellaneous handhelds, the handhelds that are not good enough to talk about in their very own episodes. And we have had a lot of episodes about handheld systems, mobile systems, portable systems. We have not really talked about these things because they're either really niche or else they're really bad, or else they're really niche and bad. So with me here in the studio to talk about bad niche handheld games, we have, of course...
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I just held a game.com in my hand for the first time and realized that it has Dragon Ball radar built in.
Bob, I believe it is just Gamecom.
Just Gamecom?
I believe so. The dot is silent.
That would confuse people. I know is you can't write that on Twitter because it will send people to game.com,
yep,
which could be porn.
That's like crossword puzzles or something.
Oh, it is? Okay. It's clean.
And so I'm Steve Lynn from the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm holding a mega duck.
And sadly, it's not a real duck.
No,
it's the original milkshake duck. You think, oh, this is a good little Game Boy clone, and then you turn it on, and you're like, oh, it's criminal.
Yes.
It's actually really bad.
Sachin wrote all the games. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. But thank you for bringing these in. I had seen most of these systems, but never actually beheld or held a mega duck before, and it's... not as bad as I expected in some ways, but in other ways, it's actually worse. It's one of those ambivalent experiences.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. And, you know, not worthy of its own full episode, but
no,
we'll talk
for
about
sure.
Today.
With a lot of these systems, it's actually really hard to know precisely how many games were created for it or even how to find the games because a lot of them were only released in like Asian territories. And they're not well documented. You know, Japanese game systems, the Japanese are great at documenting everything. Like, we know every single Famicom or PlayStation game, like, exactly the date that that was released, down to the minute. But then you get to things like this, and it's even more nebulous than European releases. At least you know which games came out in Europe, even if the official dates that Nintendo kept or Sega kept were, like, 1990. At least, you know, there's like a solid list of games that were released in that territory. Whereas here, Mega Duck, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, there's been even cases where people have a game with a different label. It's the same game. Yeah, and even the title screen's the same as the, as the original. So, I mean, it's just slapping labels on like third-rate games, basically.
But since we are not just focusing on a single specific portable system or family... I wanted to use this episode to kind of recount the history of handheld video games, and this may or may not have been prompted by another project that I just did where I actually did like recount the entire history of portable gaming, so it's all fresh in my mind, but it would be good to kind of get this down officially and formally in a Retronauts episode. So let's talk a little bit, before we talk about handheld video game systems, about the toys that came before handheld systems and how these things evolved from those, because I do think there is a very clear through line of evolution from, you know, wooden toys that kids would play with, like those little puppets where you'd squeeze the handle and the puppet would move around on a string, to something like Mega Duck. So I've put together a little section here called Vintage Handheld Toys and Gadgets. I might post some of these images to the website, although you can probably just as easily picture them in your mind. But going all the way back to the old ball and cup, do you guys remember these? I remember when the very first ball and cup was released because I'm that old.
I'm more of a paddle ball guy, although
I see.
That never worked.
No.
It's you, basically you swinging the paddle and the ball.
The ball missing.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
Or snapping off that flimsy elastic string.
Right. That's like stapled onto the ball. Right.
No, the ball and cup is I just went with that because it's kind of a just an easy reference point. Like I think everyone knows what a ball and cup is, even if they haven't played with it. I think it's just one of those things that's in kind of like the collective consciousness, like a rotary phone. But yeah, a ball and cup is basically a wooden cup on a wooden stick, and it had a string attached to it, and on the other end of the string was a little wooden ball, or a plastic ball, as it came along later. And the goal there was just to toss the ball into the air and catch it with the cup. it's not very complicated, but, you know, in the days before television, that's kind of how you found your entertainment. It was better than, I don't know, picking fleas off cattle or whatever people did for fun back then.
Yeah.
My grandmother would take us to Amish country a lot because we live near Amish country, and I swear we would go to these Amish toy stores, and I think every toy was based on Ball and Cup, and I just thought, you poor bastards. I get to go home to Nintendo, and you have like five variants on Ball and Cup.
Oh, that's all right. We both grew up in Ohio because I was going to have the same memory.
Oh, really? So, okay. Yeah. I also didn't have to help like raise barns or do like field work or whatever.
On the other hand, they had some badass quilts. What did you have, Bob?
That's true, but which one of us are podcasters now?
Yeah.
Are there any Amish podcasters?
There might be.
Prove me wrong.
Speaking into a tin cup and a string.
Well, no. They have like rollerblades and cell phones. So it's just variations on existing technology or something. Mm. Boy, we are going off the rails here.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all good.
From
this kind of toy, I think there was a pretty big revolution in toy manufacturing in the 1950s and 1960s. You know, basically after World War II, as commerce expanded, became more global, manufacturing expanded, became more efficient, and of course, above all, relevant to this, plastics evolved from fragile and brittle melamine to the modern plastics we know today. It became very inexpensive to mass produce objects very consistently, very reliably, and they tended to be fairly durable compared to, you know, something handmade. And even if a ball and cup, which was made of wood, was more durable, it, you know, had to be crafted by hand or, you know, machined, and it was more expensive, whereas plastic toys could be much cheaper. So, you know, you started to get things like plastic ball and cups. But you also got things like Ultra Hand, created by Nintendo, who had spent the 1950s and 1960s saying, what the hell are we as a company? Are we into instant rice? Are we into sex hotels? We don't know. Let's try a little bit of all of it. And a guy named Gunpei Yokoi created a little gadget in his spare time and impressed the company president, Hiroshi Yamauchi, so much that Yamauchi was like, let's make this a product. Let's put it out. Let's mass manufacture it. And that was Ultra Hand, and I never owned an Ultra Hand, but I definitely, as a kid, had something that was derived from Ultra Hand. I assume, I don't know, Steve, did you have anything like that?
So when I was a kid, I didn't have an Ultra Hand, but I do now, and the rubber tips are kind of like,
I'm sure they're
they're dried out and crumbling. But I had very similar toys back in the day, and I think I still dig them out every once in a while when you're a toy collector. So
do you want to describe how an Ultra Hand works?
Well, it's basically like a scissor mechanism, and like when you squeeze one end, it just extends out, and then at the very end are little grippy hands that grab onto things. And so included in the box, I think, were little stands and a little ball, or two of them, and you just kind of move things from one to another. I think on the box itself, there's kids like stealing some guy's wallet.
Or like a briefcase.
Yeah.
I mean, I never used one of these, but it looks like it's just engineered to pick up the little sort of pawn-looking things that come with it, really.
Right. Yeah, but the cover promises, like, you know, live a life of crime, cast down the hoi polloi, and become the Robin Hood of the neighborhood.
The child revolution has begun.
Yes, exactly.
With Ultra Hand.
Rise up, comrades. The Ultra Hand shall become the Ultra Fist.
Yeah.
But in addition to major gadgets like this, which were really cool and innovative, you also had toys that began to be manufactured. And these start to look a little more like what we think of as handheld games, except, of course, they weren't electronic. They were just pieces of plastic where you had various feats of dexterity to perform. So the one I put on here is the Jiggle Puzzle, where it's basically a plastic tray with a clear plastic lid. So everything is sealed inside. And the plastic tray has little holes in it, and then you have several balls, little plastic balls or maybe steel balls or something, inside the plastic container. And your goal is just to land those balls, roll them around on the tray until they fall into the holes, and you get different scores based on which targets you manage to hit. Like if you manage to get the moon and give the moon a nose, you get a double score. Otherwise, if you land on Venus for some reason, maybe just it's misogyny, you get no score.
These were always party favors when I was a kid, and I hated them because they were not fun and they were cheap, and I was spoiled and had a Game Boy. But I see that you have next Labyrinth.
Yep. These could not be sold now.
Why? Choking hazard or
no.
Just frustration?
Because these were – well, I guess this one's just like a little ball, but the ones that I had as a kid – They had Quicksilver inside. They had they had mercury, like a little blob of mercury. And I get there was like a dusting or something on the surface of the labyrinth to cause the mercury to roll really cleanly. And you would just, again, use gravity to roll the ball of mercury around to find the target.
Well, the one I had was a wooden set that had two knobs and the wooden maze with pivots.
Yeah. That's a different kind of labyrinth.
That's like an old school, like a really old school labyrinth game, right?
Yeah, with the holes.
Yeah. The holes. And each one is numbered, so you know how far you can make it. Like, I think that is why I enjoy Dark Souls now, because I grew up just banging my head against labyrinth and getting to like hole 9 and never getting past it. But I have so much familiarity with these really old toys, and I don't. Yeah. I'm not that old.
No, I mean, I think they still sell a lot of these because they are good for kids, you know. They're not as exciting as Fortnite, but they are good for kind of developing dexterity. And, you know, if you're stuck somewhere and you've got nothing to do, when you're a kid, you can focus more on things like this and be entertained for a while by something simplistic like rolling a blob of mercury around and then opening up the case and eating the mercury and seeing what happens.
Getting superpowers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that's how it works. So you also had things like small spring-loaded target things where you would press a button and a spring would cause a ball bearing to shoot up in you. It was basically pachinko, but like single targets. Or I think before the show we were talking about little pneumatic devices.
Yeah, they were filled with water and you'd push in a button and it would shoot bubbles that would make something happen. The one I had was basically like a basketball free-throwing game where you would squirt the bubbles and the guy would throw the ball.
Yep.
At a certain like distance.
I definitely had or saw one of those as a kid. I had one that had little rings and fish. Mm. And you were kind of like trying to cause the fish to go through the rings by using the bubbles to lift everything up.
Yeah, honor system for scoring, right?
Yeah.
Turn
the
little dial.
I guess I won.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where these handheld devices came from. But in the 1970s, electronics began to become miniaturized and room-sized computers suddenly could be compacted down to little solid-state devices. You know, that didn't draw a lot of power compared to vacuum tubes. You just had resistors on there, and I think it was, you know, probably these devices were before solid-state integrated chips, but you know, they were simple enough that it was basically like you had a calculator, and so you started seeing these handheld electronic devices reach the market and kind of take the place of these other devices we were talking about, like the handheld mercury blob and things like that. They were all kind of the same size, and they used electronics to create a new form of entertainment that was still very much kind of in the vein of the old. There were also things like battery-powered devices that weren't computerized, but they did have motorized elements to them.
Blip.
I remember – what's that?
Blip is one of them.
I don't remember that one.
It's kind of like a Pong-like thing where – there's gears and everything, and it moves the ball back and forth.
The one that sticks out in my memory is basically like a racing game mm-hmm. where you have a little plastic car on a stick, mm-hmm. and then underneath it there is a paper or cloth roll, and a battery powers basically like a roller that causes the road that's printed on the paper to scroll underneath the car, and you just try to avoid objects and I guess – stay on the road. There's not really much of a game to it, but you can kind of see where something like that is very much sort of an analog interpretation of a game like Turbo, mm-hmm. which was, you know, 1981 Sega, I think, and was kind of the same thing, except the computer was doing everything for you so you could actually crash, and if it crashed, then the game was like, hey, you crashed, as opposed to you crash and say, ah, who cares? I'm just going to keep playing because no one's watching.
Yeah. Well, I think they usually when you hit something in that game, it would just flip a switch and turn a thing actually red, right?
Oh, okay. So, could be. Yeah.
If you watch in Dawn of the Dead, the original movie, in the scene where they're just messing around in the mall, you can see one of these racing games, these like non-digital racing games for like 5 seconds. And when I saw this movie as a kid, I'm like, what the hell is that? It's not even like a video game.
Yeah, you could also play those in arcades. I mean, a lot of these things are kind of like compact versions of arcade amusements from the time. But the ones that were kind of revolutionary were the Mattel LED handhelds. I think other companies made them, but Mattel was the company that everyone kind of remembers. And These devices have even been reissued in kind of modern versions, much smaller, but the premise is still there. And basically, they are, you know, about the size of maybe a little bigger than a Game Boy. And then they had a little screen on them, which was actually just clear plastic. And underneath that, you basically had a grid or a field of LED dots. And it was a very computer, very simple computerized simulation of a sport. And you could always tell what sport it was supposed to be because it said in clear letters, basketball or baseball or football. And the plastic screen, so to speak, was silkscreened with kind of an image of the court or the field that you played on. And, you know, the LEDs were placed in strategic spots around that field. And you kind of got the idea of what you were playing. It was very loose, but it still worked. I had several of these as a kid. I couldn't find the one that I remember the most, which was a basketball game, but it's different than Mattel's Basketball 2 because it actually came in a device. It was round, shaped, and textured like a basketball, and then it had, you know, the screen inside. And I don't know if the ergonomics on that were great, but when Nintendo was showing off its Wii remote prototypes and you started seeing those, like, the weird star-shaped remote that they tinkered with, like, to me, that just immediately called back to that ridiculous basketball LED game that I had. But did you guys own any of these LEDs? I assume you must have. These were ubiquitous.
I never did because when I was younger and I saw these at flea markets in the, I don't know, late 80s, early 90s, I had no idea, like, how to interface with them. And I was going to ask you, Jeremy, because you played them when they were new. Did you have to read instructions first to know what everything means? Just because it seems so abstracted, I wouldn't know how to make sense of it.
I played these when I was, like, 4 or 5. So okay. I don't remember that well, but, you know, it is abstracted, but you play enough and you kind of get the idea over time of what you're supposed to do.
The football
they are very simple.
Yeah. Football, you have control over the line, okay. for lack of a better term. And so you kind of get, oh, if I'm on offense, I need to get past these other lines that are moving up and down. And so, like, kind of like a running back.
Okay. The football one looked especially complicated when I was little. Like, I don't even know what this is. It looks like Christmas tree lights or something. In a box.
Yeah, baseball was probably the most obvious because the little LED line of illuminations goes doot, doot, doot straight down from
the
pitcher's mound to the base, to home base. God, boy, me and my sports, I'm a pro. But it's pretty easy, pretty obvious that you need to swing the ball or swing the bat and hit the ball. Wow. And I don't remember exactly how the base running worked, but, you know, it would do the stuff with the sports and the things and – it wasn't great, but it did the trick. When you're 5 years old and you kind of know how to play sports anyway, they were decent enough in their way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was growing up, we would drive from Ohio to, like, Washington, D.C., and it was a 6-7 hour drive, and I remember there was a couple of those drives where I basically just played football the entire drive. So for 6 hours, I'm watching these little LEDs run around and...
Yeah, and because they were LED-based, like, they sipped battery power.
Yeah.
It wasn't like an Atari Lynx or something.
Yeah.
those batteries, they would run forever.
Yeah, and they were a lot of fun for the time. I think, you know, there's that – you mentioned they got reissued because a lot of people just have that nostalgia. And even if they don't play it, it's almost just turning it on and hearing the beeps and bloops.
I see them as keychains more often now.
Yeah.
Or at least, like, in the early 2000s, they started popping up as keychains.
Yeah. And I think one of them is used for, like, a prop in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy or something.
Probably.
It's, like, very clear that it's one of the Mattel footballs.
I haven't seen Stranger Things yet. Are they in – I'm sure all these products are present in that series.
I would hope so.
All right, so, you know, kind of beyond this prototypical phase of proto-video games, handheld games, we move into something more akin to the modern era, and we start out thanks to a guy named Ralph Baer, who in 1978 helped create with Milton Bradley the Simon. And surely everyone remembers Simon because that was just pervasive throughout pop culture. Like, if you've seen 80s movies, that take place in a real-world setting, you've probably seen a Simon, or you've probably played one yourself.
Was that an E.T.? Was Simon an E.T.? Am I thinking of something else?
No, that was it was Speak and Spell.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that was kind of like the same idea where you would type something in and it would use voice synthesis to speak it back. But Simon was way before that, and it was very simple. It was a round disc, probably about the size of, I don't know, like an iPad actually. And it was a black disc. It was about 4 inches tall. And on top of the black disc, there were four colored panels. And what would happen is you would start it up, and it would start playing a random sequence of lights and color. Each of the colored panels would light up in sequence. You would start with one, and then two, and then three, and you never knew what the pattern was going to be. So basically the idea was, it was like Simon says. So whenever a panel lit up, you would press that panel. When multiple panels lit up in sequence, you would press the proper sequence to replay it back. And it was just a memory game to see like how many patterns can you recognize, how many can you play back. And I was never that good at it because my short-term memory is terrible. But I did see a video a few weeks ago that made me feel really bad. It was a monkey playing Simon and doing – or something similar to Simon and doing an amazing job of just like dozens of – a sequence that was dozens of button presses long, dozens of items long. It would just like – would play it back. Apparently that's because humans supposedly sacrificed their short-term recall in order to develop speech. And because monkeys don't have speech, they have great short-term memory recall.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
I don't know if that's true, but I believe it.
Yeah. Well, the fun thing actually, if you look up commercials for Simon on YouTube, they make it seem so much more exciting than the game actually
is.
There's like people like high-fiving and slapping this thing, and it's going much faster than the game actually runs.
I want comments from fellow former nervous children like me where I hated this game. It introduced me to anxiety for the first time, and it's like, hey, do you want to feel bad? Here's a game you could never win that buzzes at you when you inevitably lose. It was just like – it was a bring down.
Wow.
It was a total bring down for me. I hated Simon. I love how it looks like this classic Star Trek console sort of look.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, it's like anxiety, the game. Like, you can never win, and it makes fun of you when you lose. It's
so
bad.
When you hear that fail sound, it just brings you back.
Yeah.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. One – fun fact that I like about Simon is they actually include a replacement light bulb inside the case.
Was that advertised?
Or did it's in the manual.
Oh, okay.
But I know when I would see toy collectors and they would see a Simon, the first thing that they do to check to see if the light bulb was there.
Huh.
Because like the taped-in light bulb is authentic or whatever.
So. I see. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Also, the launch party at Studio 54.
I did not know about that. I could see where if you're like really stoned and drunk that this would be extremely fascinating.
Yeah, you know? And this showed up as a billion mini games in everything, every other video game that was ever made. Like, oh, we need something for the player to do? Make him play a Simon game briefly.
Yeah. Yep, and it actually showed up as a mini game 1 year later in Parker Brothers' big breakout device, the Merlin. Which I did own. It was basically like a portable telephone that you saw in the 80s. But it was kind of also at the same time looked a little bit like Maximilian from The Black Hole, the evil robot.
They grow angular.
Which actually the movie actually came out a year later. I don't know if he was inspired by the design of this, but he's, you know, the same red color. And the head of Maximilian was actually the same shape as the top of this. So... like, to me, it was always, like, kind of, you know, like, wow, it's the Maximilian phone or whatever I thought it was. But
it looks like a future version of the famous red phone in the Oval Office.
Yeah,
just
pretty
like
much. Yeah.
Your nuke phone.
Yeah.
And Reagan's got a Merlin on his desk.
And then to kind of carry forward the digital phone metaphor, the body, the main body of Merlin has 11 buttons. There's a 9x9 grid and then one button on top and on bottom of the grid. And each of the buttons on the grid lights up with an LED, and you use this to play things like tic-tac-toe, or I guess you can't do Connect Four, but you can do Surround, and it has a Simon-style memorization game. And then on the bottom panel, there's a few little buttons to like choose a new game and switch which game you're playing. But it was a simple device, but pretty mesmerizing. It might have been just that I liked it because it reminded me of The Black Hole, which because I was a child, I enjoyed. But, you know, it's the closest video games had gotten to Ernest Borgnine by that point.
Yeah, I think I only remember playing tic-tac-toe on that. I saw these things surround and everything else, but I can't remember playing those games. So it's just like tic-tac-toe device for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's very intuitive as a tic-tac-toe device. It works very well. All right, so we move on to the first actual portable video game. And I know we've talked about this in passing before on Retronauts, but we haven't given it a proper analysis, and that's the Milton Bradley Microvision, which was released in 1979 and was the first LCD-based portable video game system with interchangeable cartridges. It was very ambitious and very bold and very expensive and very clumsy and very fragile. And I did not own one at the time, for sure. I do own one now, and it does not work because, as I mentioned, these are very fragile. Steve, I feel like this is something you might have had experience with.
Yeah, so I had one of these as a kid, but I didn't. I only had Star Trek and then Blockbuster with
Which was the pack-in, right?
The pack-in game. And I seem to remember it stopped working pretty quickly. And because you had – when you remove the cartridge, I guess, it actually has the processor in it, and then it exposes basically everything that's on the board. And so as a kid, I mean, I'm only probably five, six when I have this thing. I'm not taking care of things. Then the buttons are it's kind of
like a membrane.
They're mushy and they're membrane and it's kind of pushing on something. So there's all kinds of things that will break.
Yeah, I think there's like foam inside that just disintegrates with time and there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, yeah. So the LCD is also, it's only what, 16 by 16?
Yep. And the screen is susceptible to rot.
Yeah, and it's really hard to see. So there's a lot of things that it really aren't in its favor, except for the fact that, you know, you could swap out cartridges and play a completely different game. I have this like random story. I went to Classic Gaming Expo in, I think, 2000, either 99 or 2000. And I met one of the designers, Jerry Carr, and Jay Smith was the other person that designed it. And I had him sign my Microvision. And then I just kind of like, oh, that's cool. I'll put it in a box or whatever. 20 years later, through pinball here in the Bay Area, I met a couple people, and one of the guys was like, oh, yeah, you know, I think my dad worked on the Microvision and the Vectrex. And I was like, oh, I've got a Microvision if you want it. I had forgotten it. I had gotten it signed. And then when I gave it to him, he flipped it over, and it was his dad's signature. So it was one of those like, hey, that's a really random coincidence. But overall, I mean, it was expensive at the time. I think I put in here it's $49.99, which, you know, today's dollars is $175, and you know the games were $20, and so it was pricey. I'm actually kind of surprised that we had one in the house.
Yeah, this was not something I was even aware of for a long, long time, like until maybe like 20 years ago or so. And you know, it's such a kind of a little blip in history that it just didn't have much coverage. Like, you know, by the time I started reading about video games, no one was ever talking about the Microvision because there wasn't, you know, in the late 80s, there wasn't a sense of like, hey, let's look back and talk about, you know, the heritage here. It was all about like, yeah, Nintendo's neat. What's next? Mm-hmm. So it was definitely something that I kind of discovered later. I would like to have played Microvision and actually experienced it when it was playable because I feel like it would be kind of interesting, you know, at least in terms of heritage. And, you know, Star Trek Phaser Strike was timed to release with the 1979 Star Trek The Motion Picture. And there was, you know, kind of a big multimedia push with that movie because it was such a big deal. Like, wow, Star Trek's coming back after, you know, the write-in campaigns and everything. But I'm wondering, like, was that the first commercially released licensed video game based on a media property? I feel like there must have been something before, but I can't. Nothing comes to mind.
Well, there's like the Fonz, right, which was an arcade game.
Oh, right. But that was just another game that they slapped the Happy Days license onto.
Yeah.
There's no VCS game before that was a licensed game?
You know, it would have been around the same time maybe, because 1977 was when the VCS launched and it had, you know, a dozen games. Mm-hmm. And then they released like a dozen more the following Christmas. So, yeah, I don't know that Star Trek Phaser Strike was the first licensed game, but it was one of the very first. And it's interesting that it would kind of show up in such a strange little place on this little archipelago of you know, little Galapagos, that's what I'm thinking of video game history. And, you know, I guess it does make sense that it's tied to Star Trek because that motion picture did have a few other firsts. Like the very first Happy Meal was a Star Trek the motion picture tie-in. So those of you who love your McDonald's, you owe everything to Star Trek.
I'm sure kids love that movie too. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. V'ger, I totally understood what was happening when I watched that movie.
There was a pretty bald lady. And also they stood around a lot looking at lights, and that was neat.
You know, now that you say that, it makes sense that we might have this because my dad took me to the Star Trek premiere, and I'm, four when that movie comes out? I had no idea. It's like I knew there was a bald person. The transporter accident just totally freaked me out, and I don't know.
Yeah, the rest of it, it's like I like that movie, but it's very slow, and it's not something that I appreciated until I was considerably older than I was at the time that this was a fresh, hot commodity in the market.
Yeah, still better than the Microvision game, though.
And Star Trek Phaser Strike was kind of like a combination between Space Invaders and Missile Command, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Yeah, it's pretty simplistic. I mean, you only have 16 by 16 grid, right. So.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically enough to do a bowling game, a pinball game, you know, a breakout clone. Mm-hmm. I guess it wouldn't have been a combination of Space Invaders and Missile Command because Missile Command didn't exist yet. But, you know, the idea was there.
So I didn't see this in action. Is it LCD in the terms of like a Tiger game where there's predetermined shapes or is it LCD like Game Boy?
No, it's a grid. It's 16 by 16 pixels. So there's not a lot there. It's one bit. So it's only on or off. And the interesting thing is that the Microvision system itself is basically the battery casing and the screen. And then, as Steve said, each cartridge had its own processor inside of it. And also, each cartridge contained the controls for that cartridge. So each game could have its own control scheme. So for Blockbuster, you had, you know, a paddle controller. But for other games, you had...
Well, the paddle was always there.
Was it?
Yeah, it's on the case part. On the cartridge.
Right, okay, yeah. But for Blockbuster, I'm looking at the photo here. You've got a thing to adjust how many balls you're given, the speed at which you play, I guess the size of your paddle, and then a start button. So it would vary, I guess, according to the game. And for games that didn't work with a paddle, then you would want, you know, some sort of control pad.
Yeah, and like Bob said, yeah, there's like a membrane underneath that just whatever button you pressed, and of course that just breaks.
So. Yeah. So a good idea, but also a little too early to have figured out what are the realities of portable gaming, because they're different than console gaming. Handheld games have different, you know, fracture points, and they have different strengths, and they were still figuring that out. So around this time, Nintendo launches the Game & Watch in 1980, but I don't think we've done a Game & Watch episode, but I feel like that merits its own episode. So we're just going to say in the chronology, after Microvision, there was Game & Watch. And then there was everyone's favorite system, the 3D Game-8. You guys have heard of a 3D Game-8, right?
I've held one, but...
Oh, well, they're one up on me.
This is the first time I've seen it in these notes, period.
Yeah, I didn't realize I'd heard of Game-8 and 3D Game-8, and I didn't realize they were two separate systems and that 3D Game-8 is 1983. So it's a 3D portable system in 1983. Take that, Virtual Boy.
Yeah, it looks a lot like I think Tomy had like the Tomytronic, which was their LCD video games where you would hold a single game. I don't think it had swappable cartridges, but... Yeah, it looks almost exactly like that.
Right.
That spaceship look.
I mean, to me, this kind of riffs on the ViewMaster, which is a much older technology from the, what, 60s? Maybe even the 50s? I don't know. I feel like everything that my grandparents had on a ViewMaster was a 1950s or 1960s property. I do love those Peanuts ViewMasters. Did you ever see those where it was there was like claymation. It was like clay models of Charlie Brown and Snoopy and everything instead of actual hand-drawn animation or whatever.
They did that with a lot of the 2D cartoons. They made little dioramas.
Yeah, those were really cool.
Yeah, I still like seeing those.
So the idea there was, yeah, you were watching and it was kind of a little 3D because it was binocular. Mm-hmm. And this is the same thing. It looks like binoculars and you stick a cartridge in there and there is, you know, a game screen inside. You have interchangeable cartridges. That's kind of impressive. But it was only released in Europe, apparently, even though it was made in Korea. It was hard to find a lot of info on this, but it seems to have been reissued a few years later as the VTech Pro Screen, and only three games are known to have been made for it. So not exactly a big breakout success.
Yeah, we're still in the LCD era, right? Other than the Microvision with the sort of bits, right? Mm. This is sort of, as you were kind of mentioning, the sort of screened on like objects, right, that are running around.
So kind of in the same vein, you have something called Grandstands Light Games. I see someone added Atom Leisure Limited here. So I guess a lot of people were behind this system. This one's also kind of hard to find information on because apparently it was only released in the UK. And most of the information I did find on it was based in the UK. But this was a portable LCD system, but instead of playing on a screen – you put the cartridge inside of it and it like created a screen that light was projected through onto a wall. But the projector had the controls built into it. So you're basically playing a game with a projector and using, you know, the opposite wall to play as your screen. Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting. Maybe not a great idea, but, you know, everyone was experimenting back then.
Yeah, I mean, it looked interesting, but as a kid, it's probably something you would want and then play for a couple minutes and like, oh, wait, what have I done? Right. I think one thing, I guess, around the same era that we also didn't talk about was sort of the Tiger LCD handheld explosion.
Right, kind of based on the Game & Watch.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's maybe another episode as well.
Yeah, everything got a Tiger game, like every TV show, every movie. There were video game ports, and very few of them were actually, you know, sustainably playable. Yeah. There were a few ones that were like, oh, I could play with this. Like the Mega Man 2 one was surprisingly good. Like I would get these because they were $10. But, yeah, that could be an entire episode just because there are so many. And I think, like, there are some websites out there that now just recreate them. You can just play them on your computer.
Yeah, I think there's even, like, MAME, right, supports a bunch of the handhelds.
Probably, yeah.
So, yeah.
I want to play Bart Simpson Cupcake Crisis.
I could see when the Analog Pocket comes out, whenever that is, that they might be able to, you know, put together, like, FPGA simulations of these because it's going to have a super high-resolution screen. So I think it would be really convincing to create those pre-drawn LCD characters in a way that like Game & Watch Gallery on Game Boy Color couldn't do.
Yeah.
I did get the kill screen on pinball for Tiger. Not quite a kill screen, but I maxed out the score. So I was pretty obsessed with that one as a kid.
Tiger pinball kill screen coming up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I learned the house.
My kill screen experience with a handheld LCD was Epic Man, which was Epic Computing's ripoff of Pac-Man. And my parents got me that. And you could get 999 points. And by God, I did.
Yeah, UFO Blaster for me. That was the one where it's just like it just stops. So like, all right, that's it.
Yeah, honestly, I think Game & Watch and Tiger Electronics and like the ColecoVision VFD games and things like that, that's at least one episode, maybe more. I don't know, because there were a whole bunch of those. And every time I go to a classic games convention or a shop in Akihabara, I find something that I've never seen before. Like my favorite is Dracula Joe, which is Dracula Castle, and it is like an LCD ripoff, I think by Epic, of Castlevania. Like, that's kind of a deep cut, but way to go.
We talked about this on the Donkey Kong episode. You know those little arcade machines that were not quite ports? They're just approximations? Like,
yeah.
Where do they fit into here?
The Coleco VFDs.
Yeah. Do they fit into here?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're going into Game & Watch now, but Game & Watch, there weren't just the little credit card-sized systems. There were also, you know, the dual-screen systems, and then there were tabletop systems that actually had kind of like lit up screens. There was light would come down through the top of it and illuminate the crystals or whatever.
I've never seen the ladder.
Screen. I've got a Mario Cement Factory that someone donated for game coverage that I, you know, if I ever get enough Game & Watch systems, I'll do some sort of episode or something to demark them. But yeah, like you kind of get into this weird space between handhelds and portables and tabletop systems with the tabletop Game & Watches, with the Coleco VFD games, and then with Vectrex.
Yeah.
Well, I deliberately left those out of this episode.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was like 4C batteries or something around this thing. So
yeah.
We're starting to get kind of heavy too.
All right, so from here, we jump ahead to the year 1990 because everything that came out in between is worthy of an episode. That is the Epic Game Pocket Computer, the Nintendo Game Boy, the Atari Lynx, and the Sega Game Gear. I don't think we've done a Game Gear episode yet, have we?
No, we
should,
haven't.
But we, and we will.
Yeah.
I just bought Binge Edwards, his Game Gear, and I have someone doing a mod on it for me. And
the McWill mod?
It's already got the McWill mod.
Yeah.
What is the mod I'm having done on it? I can't remember.
Video out.
Oh, yeah, video out. Yeah. That's right.
It runs on kerosene now instead of
yes.
8 AA batteries.
It's man-powered. It's got a little little bicycle attached
to it.
Oh,
you have your bike, right? You
can just connect it up? The elliptical, yeah.
Right.
That's how I play video games.
Right.
I only power them myself. No, in 1990, there was the Game 8, which is not the 3D Game 8. It was produced by Bit Corporation, which was, I think, Hong Kong-based and is the first, I would say, like proper Game Boy clone. It, like you look at it and it is very Game Boy-ish, except it's a landscape format instead of portrait. So the controls are on either side of the screen as opposed to below. So kind of Game Gear looking or Lynx looking, but you know, with a Game Boy screen in the middle. So imagine the chunky form factor of the Lynx combined with the bad screen of the Game Boy, and you really get the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, I saw this when I traveled to Asia, and I mean, even then you knew it was a bad Game Boy knockoff, and so I just totally ignored it. But I mean, nowadays it's like, I kind of want to see what the games were like, because there's a lot of them. Right?
Yeah, apparently there's about 70, and from just looking at the titles, it seems like a lot of them are ripoffs of games that you would know and love. But, you know, it is on this very cheap plastic-looking system with a bad screen. It's four-shade monochrome, just like Game Boy. And the resolution is slightly higher than Game Boy, 160 by 152 pixels. But it just doesn't look like something you're going to jump out and say, I got to have this.
Yeah, I think for the next couple handhelds that we're going to discuss, this is stuff that really you didn't see much in the United States, right? This is going to be either Asia or Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the next one, the Watara Supervision, is something that I did see advertised in the U.S. I think it was released here.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was in
like Sharper Image or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember exactly where it was, but I did see it advertised in catalogs. And I thought, well, that looks like a weirder, bad Game Boy. I don't want that. Not only was it a weird, bad Game Boy, it even shipped with a game that was basically Alleyway minus Mario inside the paddle called Cristoball. No, Cristball. Christball.
Yuck.
Yes, that's it. Christball. So the interesting thing about this is that it wasn't a folding system like the DS or the Game Boy SP or the DS, but it did have like a hinge between the controls, which, you know, it was basically arranged like a Game Boy with screen on top, controls on the bottom. But in between, there was kind of like this, you know, like on the back of a semi-trailer. Or like
the bellows?
Yeah, like a, or, you know, like a reticulated bus or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess you could like tilt the screen forward and backward for the optimal angle. Although the trick with screens like this is that there is no optimal angle. It's always a bad experience. It's four-shade mono, 160 by 160 pixels. So again, about the same size as Game Boy, but slightly higher res and probably just as blurry and just as hard to see.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Kevtris has FPGA cores for both this and the Game Mate, right?
Yes. Both of these are on the Analog NT Mini.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not made use of either of those because I feel like I'm not going to get the true Game 8 experience if I can actually see what's happening with glorious RGB out video or in HD. It just kind of loses something of the authenticity.
I'm just eagerly awaiting Supervision Works.
Keep waiting. It looks like there were about 65, 66 games released for it.
Wow.
Again, none of them have any cachet whatsoever. And again, many of them based on their titles and some of their screen, their cover art appear to be based on popular series.
I see a Pac-Man looking guy.
That
I see
is,
a Donkey Kong
what is
looking
that called?
Guy.
Mari Island. So not only does it look like Pac-Man, it kind of sounds like
Mario
and probably is an Adventure Island ripoff. But yes, there is Super Kong and Snake and then something Kid. I don't know. I think that's a Momotaro game because it looks like there's a Peach on there. Actually, that might be the Adventure Island ripoff because that kid looks like Master Higgins beating up a stingray, I guess. No, it's a cobra. Okay. Maybe it's a cobra from Snake. Oh, Nemo Kid. I think that's what it's called. Anyway, yeah, video games. The Supervision, like I said, it was released in the U.S., but only in like weird catalog arrangements as far as I know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the how do we differentiate ourselves from the Game Boy, right? So it's the hinge, and I think most press shots of it actually had the screen bending. It's like you can't do that with your Game Boy. And,
right. But they did release it in a later model that just took away the hinge and looked straight up like a Game Boy.
Well, and if I remember, at least when I saw it in Europe, it was almost the same price as a Game Boy. So I don't know why you would pick this, but anyway.
I guess, you know, if you couldn't find a Wellback Holdings Mega Duck, then you went with the Watara Supervision.
Well, let's move on to the Mega Duck.
I'm holding the Mega Duck for the first time in my life. Can Mega Duck beat WonderSwan? In the Battle of Bird Consoles.
It absolutely cannot. Swans are vicious. Mm. They're almost as bad as geese.
That's true. And I'm noticing that like how every company is getting around the patent on the cross pad by making everything very painful.
Yeah, the Wellback Holdings Mega Duck has one of the worst D-pads I've ever used in my life. I remember when PlayStation came out and it had that like disconnected like the four arrows that kind of point together, I thought, ooh, that looks really rough. And sure enough, when I played Street Fighter 2 on that, boy, howdy, did that hurt like hell. But, you know, I got used to it, and there weren't a lot of games after the analog system came out that really used it. But this, you have like four little – they are Tic Tacs.
Yeah.
They are Tic Tacs. What
sharper.
Flavor is that? I think they're Spearmint Tic Tacs.
Yeah.
And there is about half an inch between the points of contact here. And it looks like – okay, so they're mounted into a circular disc that kind of looks like it might be one of those, you know, like an Intellivision-style disc or like the NES Max or something where it's – you can depress it. But no.
Yeah.
It's not interactive. So to control the game – oh, Lord. Yeah, that's just –
Before
bad.
I picked it up, I assumed that disc in the middle was going to pivot with the controls. Nope.
Nope.
It's all an illusion.
What, do we have the sound here?
Oh,
That's the boot up.
Why you got to do that to us?
Can you put the Mega Duck OST on YouTube? Just upload that?
Yeah. For Snake Roy.
ASMR.
Put it on vinyl.
Right.
So I will say this for the Mega Duck. It has the exact same screen resolution as the Game Boy. And again, 4-shade monochrome. But the audio quality is much, much worse. The D-pad is terrible. And for some reason, both the Supervision and the Mega Duck really like to color their buttons kind of this turquoise color. I don't know what that was about. It's not an attractive color. Gamecom has that too. Like, what's up, people? I guess it was the 90s.
Yeah. I mean, it's time for clacks and, you know, pastels.
And these weird, like, tertiary colors.
I didn't know about the Mega Duck until I met Frank Cifaldi, and he told me about that. Actually, I think he showed me the Cougar Boy first.
Right. Cougar Boy is just the other name of Mega Duck. Cougar Boy is the naughty version of Mega Duck.
Yeah.
Is that related to Snake Roy, who is one of the key figures?
Those are my favorite mascots. Metal Gear guys. You've got Solid Snake and Roy Campbell.
What bothers me is the contacts are jutting out of these cartridges. It's like weird, like console body horror. The skin has been ripped away. It felt like I was afraid to pick these up. I didn't want to touch them.
Yeah, other than the name, which is goofy, the cartridges and the names and the art on them themselves is actually my favorite part of the Mega Duck because it is that sort of knockoff. There's this like Taiwan Cooper Games where they have absurd art and descriptions on the back, and it just kind of carries through to these games.
These remind me of, I don't know if you've seen this online, but there are like Polish bootleg posters of movies.
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
these remind me of, these covers.
Or like the African.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Where they couldn't get license the rights to the likenesses, so they just kind of made stuff up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually kind of like the – as a collector, I kind of like the exposed contacts here because at least they're going to be easy to clean.
That's
Whereas
true, yeah.
cleaning Game Boy games is a real pain. You have to get some sort of cleaner and rub it in there with a Q-tip. It gets to be a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, and if you've never heard of the Mega Duck, definitely look it up online and check out the art and the system. You don't need to own the system. Don't worry about that part.
So you mentioned that Frank Cifaldi is the one who introduced this to you, mm-hmm. and that's not surprising because the developer for Megaduck, like all but one of the 24 known Megaduck games, was developed by Sachin, the, I guess, Taiwanese
yep.
company
mm-hmm.
that did a lot of bootleg NES stuff, and that Frank managed to convince to create the game Huge Insect. So it all kind of comes full circle. Sadly, there was never a Huge Insect port to Mega Duck. But there was an interesting variant that I found mentioned in a couple of places called the German Learn Computer. It's an educational device. Can you guess it from the name Learn Computer? but it, like an educational mini computer based on the Mega Duck hardware. So I feel bad for those kids. I'm sure what they learned was not to trust adults.
They're playing Snake Roy Math
yes,
on their
absolutely.
Mega Duck.
How many snakes are there? There's solid, there's liquid, there's solidus.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what a puppet knight teaches English or something.
Beast Fighter looks kind of amazing. I love that logo. It's
yeah.
really.
What? Well, it's like Primal Rage.
Yeah, but except with basically it looks like the Dinobots, but made flesh.
What is the one sitting closest to you with this?
Oh, the Thomas the Tank Engine?
Oh, man.
Yeah, it looks like Thomas the Tank Engine, but it's actually just Pipe Dream.
He's out of
literally,
control.
It is, that is literally just a Pipe Dream ripoff.
This is pretty nightmare-inducing. I like it, though.
Yeah.
Look up Railway for Mega Duck. Great cover.
All right. I think we need to take a break because we're about to enter the R zone, so we got to prep ourselves. Friends to the R zone. So Tiger Electronics was well known for their LCD handhelds that were big Game & Watch ripoffs, except based on every license imaginable. And they said, what if we did that but Virtual Boy? And boy, that sure was a thing. The R zone was not even really a handheld system. It was head mounted. You wore it as like a headband. And it had this little flip-up visor that popped out and projected, like reflected a game onto it. And the games were just Tiger LCD handhelds, except on a little like scouting visor. So you could see if your score was over 9,000.
You could read Goku's power level
yep.
at the same time.
Yep. Actually, there was no Dragon Ball game for the system, so missed opportunity.
I think it was too early.
Yeah, it was in the U.S., yeah, this thing is weird, and it was always really confusing to me because I had heard of it but didn't really know anything about it. And then Toys R Us decided to call their game section the R Zone in the late 90s. And the difference was that the R was backward. And I, for a long time, I was like, so this is Toys R Us like promoting this game system that I heard of? No, they had nothing to do with each other. It was just a weird choice, I guess. Anyway, the R Zone is the only console that suits your T Zone. Looks right over your face and lets you play the games that normally would be on a little pocket-sized handheld.
Yeah, these press photos are extremely misleading in terms of the experience.
I would say extremely.
Extremely
misleading. Because it was the 90s, the mid-90s. So, you know, I think there was an article I read. It might have been Wikipedia or maybe like a handheld blog said that they were trying to seize on the hype surrounding Virtual Boy by creating a virtual reality system that wasn't, that used the black and red color scheme of Virtual Boy. And wow, can you imagine thinking there was hype around Virtual Boy? Like, that must have been a decision made in a very, very specific window of time. Because on either side of that, you'd either never heard of Virtual Boy or realized, well, that was not a good idea. But no, Tiger went all in.
What a thing to hit your wagon to.
Yeah,
Virtual
Boy.
It's like...
But they really believed in this thing, and it came out in multiple variations. There was one... It was kind of like a Lynx-looking handheld where the eyepiece screen was built into the handheld and flipped up. And then there was another one that was kind of a chunky-looking Game Boy wannabe. Actually, it kind of looks like a PC Engine GT or the Turbo Express, kind of that sort of chunky style. And the screen on it was actually just the usual Tiger LCD handheld.
So it's like the R Zone without the R.
Right.
Kind of like a 2DS
it's just the zone.
Or something?
It's
yeah,
the zone.
But you're still playing those classic Tiger-style games, right?
Yes. Classic, yes. That's the word I was going to use, classic.
But, like, as a kid by 95, I don't think anyone I knew was playing these. By, like, 92 or 93, you're like, this is getting kind of old.
Yeah, but this was 1995,
yeah.
So they really missed the boat there. But they kept coming out with new versions. There was even, like, a pocket organizer version that had a full keyboard and could do calculations and stuff. It had a little separate LCD screen with proper, like, you know, pocket watch style LCD to do whatever organizing you needed to do. And then there was a little window on the left side that allowed you to play games. It looks like it must have been like 1 by 1 inch, maybe slightly larger. But it's interesting because it had a lid that would flip down, and there was a little window for that 1 inch by 1 inch screen, so you could play your pocket game or your Tiger pocket game. And the cover also had a little cutout for the D-pad in the bottom right corner, and I guess the buttons on the right side.
Maybe they're like, okay, the Virtual Boy connection wasn't great. Maybe the Cybico is the next thing.
Yeah, I guess.
Start ripping that thing off, so.
Anyway, this thing lasted for a long time.
Wow.
I mean, it was around for a while, but it was all built around basically 1980 technology in the late 90s when color handhelds were coming out, even from Nintendo, and they just clung to that.
Well, it was Tiger handhelds went around for a really long time, and it was just like that sort of budget thing,
sure,
right?
Sure.
It didn't
like,
chew through batteries.
Yeah.
You just kind of throw it in the back of a truck.
Yeah, the equivalent of, you know, a cup and ball.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's super cheap and super disposable.
Yeah, I think there were maybe $12 or $13 at the time, maybe $15 retail, I'm guessing, something like that.
Yeah, cheaper than a Tamagotchi. Also a lot more limited than a Tamagotchi, but there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say that Tiger somewhat redeemed themselves with their final, I think, venture into handheld gaming, and that was the Gamecom, not game.com, just Gamecom, even though there's a dot in there. This was the beginning of the like the dot-com era where the internet was like this crazy new thing, and you know, there were movies like The Net where Sandra Bullock would go to the beach and use a laptop, even though there was no such thing as a Wi-Fi connection back then. She could still get on the internet. Tom Cruise could find a secret clue by going on to Usenet and posting to Job 316 or 314 or whatever. Anyway, I own at least two albums from about 1990 by old bands that called it like the band. The album name was like thisband.com. There was jtull.com by Jethro Tull. And there was Marillion.com by Marillion.
I remember things like Garbage 2.0, that album.
My favorite thing about this little boom was Marillion.com was the album, but the EP that went alongside it was Marillion.co.uk. I thought that was kind of cute.
Okay. That makes sense.
It's actually an okay album.
Oh.
Anyway, that has nothing to do with any of this, but it's just like kind of the same idea. I don't think Tiger actually registered game.com as a domain. So registering their or naming their product after a domain on the internet that they did not own seems questionable. But it was at least an ambitious device. It kind of feels like they prefigured the Neo Geo Pocket by a year with this. It's a monochrome system with much higher visual resolution than Game Boy, 200 by 160 versus 160 by 144.
Mm-hmm.
And it had interchangeable cartridges. It had an organizer function, kind of like the R-Zone organizer version, but much tidier.
Mm-hmm.
It had things like Let's see. There's a pocket calculator, an organizer. I think there was a fortune teller, and that's something that has showed up in the Neo Geo Pocket.
Mm-hmm.
There was a version of it called the Pro that had a backlit screen and a touchscreen. There was a touchscreen built into this thing before the DS. Like they were really trying. They really mm-hmm. were like, let's do something new and innovative and good. And the system was actually pretty powerful. I don't know if I put the hardware specs in here. No, it looks like I didn't, but. Mm-hmm. It had decent power, and they went out and made an effort to license up some pretty big franchises from the era, not Nintendo, but definitely PlayStation and Sega. And only 20 games came out, but like twice that many were announced and licensed and in development. The games that did come out included Sonic Jam, Batman and Robin, Duke Nukem, and Resident Evil 2. And none of these were actually that good. And I think the system is probably most famous now for the announced but never released Metal Gear Solid and Castlevania Symphony of the Night ports.
We need to find those.
I know people who have played them, or at least, yeah, I think they've played both. I think Shane yeah. Bendhausen has played them.
Like the Game Boy Color Resident Evil port came out illegally, but it leaked out. And based on – so former guest of the show and current guest, I guess, Gary Butterfield, said that the Game Boy Color port of Resident Evil is way better than the GameCom port of RE2.
Makes sense. I can see that. It feels like they were trying to do a lot with a system that the system wasn't quite up for.
Yeah, it's really kitchen sinky, right? It's kind of – oh, we have all these disparate parts. Let's kind of throw it into one device.
Did we mention emails on
Yeah, you can check
yeah.
the email.
Yeah. The very first version had a 14.4 internet connection, 14.4 kilobaud. Not great, but, you know, better than Game Boy could do. Although a few years later, there was a Game Boy, like, peripheral released that allowed you to go online. And mostly people used it for trading Pokemon and Pokemon Crystal. But I recently did a video on Napoleon for Game Boy Advance, which was a strategy game Nintendo released only in Japan and France. And the Japanese version of that could also use that video or the online adapter so you could play head-to-head for like a year against other people who had Napoleon. Hmm. So it was in the air, but still not great.
Yeah, you can see them playing to the company's strengths on licensing titles
mm-hmm.
because they had done it for the handheld LCD games for so long. I'm sure they had the existing relationships. Like, well, yes, it's competing against the Game Boy and some of these other things, but we've already done business before, and why don't you release a Duke Nukem or Resident Evil or, you know, they even did like what, Simon's Quest, I think, for LCD handheld.
So. Oh, yeah, the Tiger version of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. It's not a great system, but it's got a lot of it's almost like you designed a Game Boy a couple of years later, but then by that point it was too late.
Yeah, it's a dense little thing too. It's got some heft to it.
Mm-hmm.
It feels pretty rugged though. Like I respect the fact that it feels like you could take this with you and it's going to keep working.
Oh, yeah. And it's got all these like 90s touches. Like when you turn it on, it's like GameCom activated, and then, you know, like little animations when it's putting in the card or checking your email.
Right.
Like the embellishment of like the envelope flying into a mailbox or whatever. So.
Yeah. And this is the Pocket Pro that you've got here. It's got the button for the light.
Yeah.
So it can be backlit. The Pocket Pro was reissued without the backlight. But because it was the 90s, these were like transparent multicolor editions because that was in the zeitgeist. Thank you, Apple.
You had to play it loud.
Mm-hmm. So after the GameCom's release in 1997, more game systems came out. Game Boy Color, Neo Geo Pocket, and WonderSwan. And we've talked about all of those in separate episodes. So we're not going to belabor the point and move ahead to the forgotten Nintendo handheld Pokemon Mini.
Hmm.
And a big part of the reason that it is forgotten, released in 2001, is because it came out a few months after Game Boy Advance, for one thing, and two... Only 4 games were released in the U.S. Only 10 games were made in total. 1 came out in Japan and Europe, and 5 came out only in Japan. So it's really hard to get a hold of the games. It's become very expensive because it didn't sell that well in the U.S., which is why they only released 4 games. but it's kind of neat. It's really tiny. It's basically like a Pocket Station or a Dreamcast VMU, mm-hmm. except despite being a tiny miniature chest pocket-sized game system, it used interchangeable cartridges that mm-hmm. you could probably like sneeze and lose them. But that's actually kind of impressive. It had an internal clock. It had an IR port. And the screen was 96 by 64 pixels, which I'm pretty sure was higher resolution than Pocket Station or VMU.
Mm-hmm.
So they put some thought into this. But basically the only things that came out for it were Pokemon games. And that's, I guess, why it was called Pokemon Mini.
Mm. How do you figure the Pokemon Pikachu into this? The pedometer slash virtual pet? It has a D-pad. It's got four buttons.
Does it have interchangeable cartridges?
It does not.
Yeah. So that's
a that's different episode.
That's a standalone
episode.
Device. That's a Tamagotchi wannabe. We could probably do a Tamagotchi episode.
That could be an episode, yeah. I love the Pokemon Pikachu.
I mean, Tamagotchi's made a comeback. So Tamagotchi and its friends would be pretty relevant. So mm-hmm. look forward to that, I guess, sometime in 2020 or 2021.
Yeah.
If I mean, the world's still here.
Look at this. It's kind of weird in terms of what is the target market for this, right? It's tiny. It's cute. You figure you'd give it to a little kid. But then you have like these micro SD
those are going to get
cards
lost.
And yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that's not going to work well for a little kid.
Yep.
So even just having a cartridge slot for something for a kid.
Yeah. It's – I don't know. It's a weird choice. You know, they were spitballing and God bless them. I forgot to mention it had force feedback. There was a rumble feature built into this tiny little device that was barely any larger than a Game Boy cartridge.
Yeah, you can see it in the corner, right?
So
it's
wild.
Like that translucent case.
Yeah. The little nub.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. So moving on to the opposite end of the spectrum, we look at the Sharp Zaris, which was released, I think, also in 2001. It's not really a game system. It's more of a personal data assistant, a PDA, which was all the rage back then. Blackberries and Newtons and things like that. I only mention it. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I think this was sort of precursor to like the Palm Pilot, mm-hmm. right? Or the Palm 1000, 2000. And because I remember someone I worked with had one of these, and it was like $600 or something. And
I mean, that's about what Newton sold for too.
Yeah.
I think you could get like a $1,200 Newton if you wanted to get the specs and spend a few months trying to train it to read your handwriting.
The Newton persists as a Simpsons joke forever.
Yep. Yes.
For all eternity.
Eat up Martha.
So the main reason I wanted to mention the Zaris, because it's not really a game system. It only had a handful of games on it. It had two of the only Nintendo games to have been licensed for a non-Nintendo platform after the NES launch. It had Balloon Fight and Clue Clue Land, neither of which were very good ports. Like, you couldn't have two-player action simultaneously in Balloon Fight, and there was no music while you played. But Balloon Fight and Clue Clue Land were on there. And I think this goes back to the longtime relationship that Sharp and Nintendo had. Because if I'm not mistaken, Sharp had a product. It was like a microwave oven or something called the Family Computer. And when Nintendo launched its Family Computer game console, they had to like come to an agreement with Sharp to use the name. And as a result, you saw Nintendo games on like Sharp X1 and mm-hmm. I think on X86000. Is that right? No.
X68000 stuff?
I don't think Nintendo was on X68000, but it was definitely like Golf and that weird Donkey Kong 3 sequel were on X1. And you had the Sharp Twin Famicom, mm-hmm. which was created by Sharp and contained both a Famicom and a disk system. So I think this was like the final little instance of that relationship coming to the fore. So you ended up with two random NES games on the Zaris.
Yeah, and so I'm guessing you just control it using the keyboard? I mean, there's no D-pad or anything on the Zaris. So.
Yeah, you did the WASDA thing.
Yeah.
Because that's how you want to play NES games.
Yeah, and those buttons were kind of like the HP 48 series style. That doesn't seem like a great control mechanism.
No, but I mean, if you want to be entertained, you will find a way. I know Scott Sharkey mm-hmm. used to talk about how he could beat the final battle of Dracula X for Super NES, the infamously crazy difficult battle mm-hmm. with Dracula on an emulator with just like the keyboard.
Wow.
Like, I can't beat that thing with a D-pad. But you abuse yourself enough and eventually you'll get to a point where it works.
Yeah.
Speaking of self-abuse, We come to the Nokia N-Gage in 2003, and this is the first of these that I actually covered as a member of the press because I was the handheld guy at 1UP.com, and they were like, here, Jeremy, you write about these, and I did.
In the notes, you had the classic Christian Nutt side talking photo.
You can't talk about the N-Gage without bringing up side talking. It's actually kind of crazy that someone in the press – several people in the press actually took part in this website, Side Talkin', which played like a terrible MIDI of the Bee Gees' Jive Talkin' when you loaded it.
I loved it.
And it was designed entirely to make fun of a product that they were covering in the press. But that was just the kind of wild, freewheeling world this was before social media.
That's how we should treat bad tech ideas, with derision and scorn.
I mean, we kind of did that with Cybertruck.
That's true. Right. Cybertruck broke on stage, though.
That's true. You can't really top that.
No one threw a rock at the Gizmodo? Wait, what are we on?
The
N-Gage. Sorry. I confused the names of the two. But the N-Gage. Sorry.
Yeah, the N-Gage was actually – it was ambitious. It was an attempt to be a proper mobile phone and also a video game system. It was a mobile phone built with kind of like D-pad functionality into the system. And that's – you know, like they saw iMode games in Japan and were like, wow, playing those games on, you know, the membrane keypad of a candy bar or flip phone, that really sucks. What if we made a game system like a phone that could also be a good game system? They almost did it. It wasn't actually a good game system, but it had a pretty powerful processor. It could do 3D badly. Games really chugged, and it had a vertical screen instead of horizontal. So it didn't flatter most games. But there was actually some interesting stuff on here, and it sold for, I think, a reasonable price. It was $300, according to the numbers written on this woman's abdomen right below her prominent breasts.
Yeah, that was the E3 price reveal, was they had a bunch of dancers on stage, and they did sort of this routine, and then she took off her shirt. And then the price was like printed on
her. She has like a swimsuit on underneath, but it's tiny. There's like definitely some underboob. It's geared right at the id of 16-year-old boys, as many things in the video games press were at this time.
I wrote at the this is just random memory, but I was at when they revealed this at E3. When you went to their booth, they had all the N-Gages on these flexible arms, or rather they were on an arm, so you had to sit and play it. But to get the right angle, you basically had to like pull it up, and so you couldn't even really see the screen unless you were sort of crouched in just the right position. So
good thing I'm short.
Yeah, just everything about that.
Yeah,
launch.
I remember. I think in 2004, the N-Gage booth at E3 was like this back alley. It was like super try-hard urban dystopia. Like lots of graffiti and stuff like that.
We're all playing N-Gage after the collapse.
I don't know, man. I mean, it wasn't like post-apocalyptic dystopia. It was just like urban blight, I guess.
Yeah.
But it just like what was the message here, guys? What are you going for?
Yeah, there's just so many odd design decisions, right? The side talking being the weirdest one.
Let's talk about what that is.
Yeah. So we have a QD here in front of us. So that's the more traditional
smaller
style.
More scaled down model.
But yeah, the mic and the headset are on effectively like the side of the phone. So you basically hold it up to your face like a taco, basically. And you have to change out the cartridges. You actually have to remove the battery because the cartridge slot's behind the battery.
That's right. I mean, that's when people actually made phone calls. We don't do that anymore.
That's true.
I reviewed one T9. Or two games on the N-Gage. I remember reviewing Ashen, a first-person shooter that was – it tried, but it wasn't that great, and the hardware just wasn't up to it. Mm-hmm. But there was also a Bomberman game. Super Monkey Ball was on there. There was an actual portable Elder Scrolls game designed specifically for this system, which didn't even happen with the PSP. As they promised it would.
Legend tells that the Monkey Ball port is all right, I think.
I can see that.
But, I mean, don't play it.
There was also Xanadu Next, a Xanadu game developed by Falcom. And it was a mess also, like 2 frames a second. It kind of reminded me of Grandstream Saga for PlayStation, if you remember that.
Wow.
How anytime there was, like, any character besides the player avatar on screen, it would just, like, frame rate drop until it was a slideshow.
Yeah.
Who needs textures?
They tried.
Yeah, well, who does? Well, there's what, a Red Faction game? I think the interesting thing is, you know, there's the N-Gage and then the QD, and then they effectively rolled like quote-unquote N-gauge technology into their other handsets, right, like the N81 or something. And so you start seeing a lot of those phone games sort of piggybacking off of this. So you start seeing like Splinter Cell and things like that that people are trying to preserve now, right, mm-hmm. because they're much more ethereal. It was things you downloaded onto your phone. But, you know, it's interesting legacy. And, of course, I wonder at what point people don't know what side talking is.
So. It's possible there's an entire generation of Zoomers who don't know right now, and now they do know thanks to us, and you're welcome. Mm-hmm.
I do miss smart devices that were not just a rectangular slab. Like and when I was in college, my girlfriend at the time had a Sidekick.
Yeah.
And those are so much fun because the screen just like popped out and the buttons were fun to push and everything. If you go back to the original Arrested Development episodes, they all have Sidekicks because I think it was product placement. But yeah. I love the Sidekick so much.
Yeah. Scott Sharkey wrote most of his 1UP.com articles on a Sidekick.
He told me that, and that's crazy. But that's very Sharkey.
It's true. He would sit down at the bar with a pint of Guinness and just type away on his Sidekick and send those in. You know, whatever works.
And then Danger spun off to, well, it was purchased by Google to form Android, right?
Hmm. So. Might be. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the provenance of Android. But speaking of mobile operating systems, our next system actually ran Palm OS. That's the Tapwave Zodiac from 2003, which kind of feels like a spiritual successor to Gamecom. It also kind of feels like a prelude to PSP and stuff like the GX32 and so on and so forth. It was a multimedia device that was capable of playing music and movies and had, you know, like a proper operating system. But it was also built clearly around games. If you look at the way it's set up with a, not a D-pad, but kind of like a stick, sort
it's
of
like
similar to the PSP.
Stick. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like the controller on the Neo Geo Pocket.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So clicky.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. So it was definitely built around games, but there weren't that many of them. There were a few. It could play Palm OS games. There were like a handful, maybe six Zodiac exclusive games, a couple of games that were enhanced on Zodiac, and then whatever homebrew you could run on Palm OS. So kind of expensive, $300 or $400 to play just a handful of games, but also to have an organizer that kind of looked like a Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, I mean, this was – Palm was actually quite hot at this time. You know, a lot of people had the Palm and Palm Pilots and the color models, and so there were a lot of games written for that. And this was just an easier way to play some of the games that existed on the OS, and then they did the sort of enhanced stuff. I remember the Tony Hawk being pretty good. I went to the launch party for this, and I think I might still have the T-shirt floating around somewhere.
All right, so finally, we're going to wrap up this journey through the obscure with the most, I don't know if it's interesting, but definitely the most lurid of all of these systems, and that's Tiger Telematics Gizmondo. Tiger Telematics had nothing whatsoever to do with Tiger Electronics, who made the R-Zone and the Gamecom. It was just a coincidence. It's a really weird system. The hardware kind of looks like Bomberman or something. Like it's got these little L&R buttons that pop out.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Like almost like valves. I don't know. There's like this tea kettle kind of look to it. It's hard to describe. I do like the rubberized texture. That was always nice. Although after 15 years, it's gotten a little tacky, which is not so nice. That's the problem with rubberized textures. But yeah, like this game system was not really designed to be a game system. It was designed to be, I'm pretty sure, a money laundering scheme for the Swedish mafia. And the guy who ran the company basically went to jail for money laundering. Mm-hmm. And he flipped an expensive sports car.
Yeah, it's Ferrari F40, I think.
Yeah.
F50, yeah.
Like, he just wrecked that thing. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the company was like $30 million in debt by the time the system launched because of the extravagant launch parties it threw with like celebrities and stuff. The launch party I went to for the press here in San Francisco was not full of celebrities. It was at this kind of grim little bar. And It was one of the first, maybe the first launch event that I'd been to, because I think I'd been to one or two more, but it definitely had a really weird vibe. They were trying to show off this system that already everyone knew was dead. Mm-hmm. And the guys who were there talking to me about it were like, oh, yeah, we're going to open this up after launch and let people just create anything they want for it. But we're also going to sell games for it, which struck me as kind of like a self-defeating approach to publishing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the thing I remember most about the launch party is that Sharky got to try a bunch of top-shelf whiskey that he'd always wanted to try but could never afford. And he was like,
open bar.
Yeah, it's right there. Yeah. Johnny Walker, whatever their most expensive, like green label or whatever. Mm-hmm. He was like, I'm going to try this. So at least someone was happy about the launch of the Gizmondo.
That's what you should do at these events, just exploit corporate waste for your own benefit.
Yeah, pretty much. I wish I had realized that at the time.
Right.
I didn't really drink much at the time. Not that I drink a lot now, but alcohol didn't have any interest to me because I was like, what's whiskey? That sounds gross.
Yeah.
So I missed out on the chance. But I did get to talk about Mama, May I Please Mow the Lawn, which sadly never launched. But that sounds like an amazing game, and I think we were robbed. The game was cut down in its prime.
Well, this seems like a lot like Gamecom, right, where they just started throwing all these. I think there's, has GPS, it's got a camera. And there was almost like some of the demos were like almost AR style, right?
Yeah, where like, it was like looking the most famous game for the system, Colors, was like a turf war gang. It was AR based, using GPS to track your actual location in the world. It was basically Pokemon Go, like 12 or 13 years early, or Ingress. Like, wow, that's they were really thinking ahead, but the market just wasn't ready for that. Yeah. Like, no one was going to own a Gizmondo. And that's a game that a lot of people have to play in order to make it work. You need the saturation of iOS and Pokemon to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like they had good thoughts. And the hardware was really impressive. It was an ARM9 processor running at 400 megahertz. The Game Boy Advance, which was still on the market at the time, was an ARM7, so two generations back, running at 16 megahertz. So this was a powerful system. It had a widescreen model was announced. It didn't actually ship, but it would have had the same screen resolution as the PSP. I don't know. Like, they put some good ideas into this and kind of accidentally stumbled into something that was almost a good system. But then because of, greed and larceny, it never actually went anywhere. But there was potential here.
Well,
it's kind of a shame.
Well, if you were laundering money, right, and there was no chance for or desire really for profitability in this thing. It's like, we'll just like create this thing, throw all the hype around it, and maybe everyone will get on board.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I suppose there are worse ways to create a system.
Yeah.
Just like throw everything together and to hell with profitability. Yeah. That's great if you can do it. Let's bring socialism into video games.
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing to come out of the Gizmondo is the story about the CEO and that Ferrari crash, and he blamed it on some mysterious German person that was driving, and it's
a one-armed man.
Yeah, exactly.
It was Snake
you
Roy.
Find that man.
It was Snake
you
Roy.
You find that man.
But yeah, it's a really fascinating story from a business perspective, and probably more interesting than any of the games that came out.
Yes, because only like 12 games came out. So.
Right.
Again, cut down in its prime.
Yeah, and this one doesn't charge, so I'm going to find a battery for it.
And nothing of value was lost.
No.
All right. So that wraps it up for our journey through obscure handheld systems. I don't think there's really been anything since then. I mean, I guess you have like the random potpourri of like Arduino-based systems or Raspberry Pi-based systems or those dumb little mini arcade games like, hey, maybe Americans want to buy a standalone device that only plays Don Doko Don and its sequel.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not the case. But, there are these little oddball systems, but there's not like an organized platform among these things as there was with something like even Megaduck.
Yeah. Well, I thought what was interesting is like that they had that Oregon Trail handheld that came out and now they're doing mini arcades and things like that are what we thought we were getting back in 82 or what we wanted in 82 just now and doesn't even matter now, I guess is the question.
I don't know, but it's neat that it exists and it's something for parents to show their kids and say, oh, I love this when I was a kid, and the kids will be like, I just want to watch some more Fortnite, please.
Yeah, I have an iPad that does everything.
What's Ninja up to these days?
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps it up for the journey through obscure handhelds. There are a couple of things we touched on this episode that we need to revisit in full and sometime in the future. So we'll do that. But in the meantime, thank you, Jeff Vlasic, for requesting this episode and making it happen. If you are interested in making an episode happen, you can do that by going to patreon.com/retronauts, where our podcast is supported on a weekly basis. There is a tier called Ultra 64, and that is where you get to make a request by supporting us at that level if you really, really want us to tackle a topic. Otherwise, it's just a potpourri of whatever we do. But that's it. I'm Jeremy Parrish. Thanks for listening. And with me here was Bob Mackey and Steve Lin. Thank you guys for joining and sharing your thoughts on esoteric handhelds and balls and cups and other things along those lines. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And thanks again, Jeff Vlasic, for making this happen. Anyway, Retronauts, you can find us weekly on the Tunes. Oh, no, not iTunes.
It's Apple Podcasts.
It's Apple Podcasts.
They've abolished all Tunes.
We're on the internet. You can find us at retronauts.com. And again, patreon.com/retronauts. Bob, what's the monthly donation? It's still $3 for,
it's $3,
for
yeah.
the weekly podcasts a week in advance,
yeah.
higher bitrate quality, no advertisements or sponsorships. At $5 a month, you also get biweekly exclusive episodes unique to Patreon that no one else will be able to listen to. And I think that's pretty cool. So if you really like us and really want to hear even more podcasts than you would normally, that's the place to go. Otherwise, you can hear us for free anywhere you want, except Android. I don't know. Are we on the Google Play Store? People used to ask that, but we couldn't be because of Podcast One, but now we're not there, so we should be there.
I think people put us places because I get comments from Podbean, like, somebody commented on your podcast on Podbean. I'm like, I don't know what Podbean is.
I guess you must be the registered email address.
No one's putting our Patreon episodes on there, so that's fine.
All right. Well, anyway, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. And you can also find me doing stuff for Limited Run Games, where I am the media curator, whatever that means. It sounds great, though. Sounds really fun. I'm looking forward to it. Bob, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo, and I have a bunch of other podcasts at the Talking Simpsons Network. Just go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons, or just look up What a Cartoon or Talking Simpsons wherever you find podcasts. We have our own Patreon, of course, patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. There's all kinds of bonus stuff on there, exclusive miniseries and so on. You probably heard them before, but if not, you want to hear me talk about other old stuff, that's where you find it. And that's all for me.
And I'm Steve Lin. You can find me on Twitter at Stephen P. Lin. And I'm part of the Video Game History Foundation at gamehistory.org. Join, support us on Patreon. You can get access to our Discord, where we have a channel dedicated to Bubsy called the Bubsy Litter Box. And then my day job is at Discord. Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week. We'll be back in 1 week with another podcast. And in the meantime, to quote the immortal Huey Lewis, I want a new Megaduck.